Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, a new homelessness czar is appointed to oversee Utah's response to the growing number of unsheltered people in the state. Local refugee resettlement groups express frustration that President Biden has yet to expand the numbers of refugees that the U.S. is willing to accept. And after 3 years in sanctuary in a Salt Lake City church, Vicky Chavez and her two daughters can now go outside the church without fear of deportation. Joining me for this conversation, we have Salt Lake Tribune reporter Matt Canham, senior federal government reporter Matt Canham. Thanks for being here, Matt. Good morning.
Good morning.
We've also got reporter, government reporter Taylor Stevens. Good morning and welcome to you, Taylor.
Good morning.
And editorial page editor George Pyle. Hi, George. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And listeners, you can join this discussion with your questions or comments. Tweet to @KCPW or call 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. There are a lot of places we could start today, but why don't we begin with a story that none of you reported. Actually, this is reported by your colleague, Courtney Tanner, and Matt Canham. I'm hoping you can just walk us through this one. It's a story that I just mentioned, that of a family that was seeking or that had sought sanctuary inside of a church in Salt Lake City to avoid deportation, a family that is now able to leave that church. This is a story that we have been following for quite some time. Why can Vicky Chavez leave Salt Lake City's First Unitarian Church?
A judge has issued a stay on her immigration case. This is the sixth attempt from her attorney to get that stay. And when Vicky Chavez first heard the news this week that she was able to leave the First Unitarian Church, she didn't believe it. It was only a month ago that a judge denied her stay. And so when her attorney sent her an email, she wanted to read the order herself, and it allows her to stay in the country for 1 year as her case continues to be considered, but it means that she is no longer under threat to be immediately deported.
How long has she been in sanctuary in the First Unitarian Church? I mean, again, she was scared of being deported. Tell us again the context as, why she decided to seek sanctuary and I guess, yeah, why that worked.
So this was back in 2018. A judge ordered her to leave the country. So she bought plane tickets for herself and her children. And before she got on the plane, she changed her mind. This is not a law in the United States, but it's definitely a custom that people can find sanctuary in places and houses of worship, and that immigration officials will not come in there. The First Unitarian Church in Salt Lake City offered her a Sunday school classroom that they could turn into an apartment for her. So she entered that sanctuary January 30th, 2018. She has not left that building, and neither have her children, for 1,168 days.
I'm going to encourage people to read Courtney Tanner's article, because aside from providing, the information that you're providing here, it's just really a beautiful piece of writing.
Right.
And so check that out, everybody. But Matt Canham, obviously, Vicky Chavez is very happy to be able to walk outside. She's been there, as you said, for more than 3 years, 1,168 days. That's a long time. This isn't the end of her story. As you said, she has a 1 year long stay. What happens after that? And then, of course, there's more to the story, including fines that were levied against her. I don't know how read you are on those, but can you tell us about that?
Yes. I mean, this is all wrapped up in politics at the federal level. Former President Donald Trump really ratcheted down the number of people who were allowed to get asylum, and his administration tried to levy more than $500,000 in fines against Vicky Chavez for refusing to leave. Her lawyers are fighting these things. The reason that this stay has happened is in part a reaction to Joe Biden becoming our new president. And she is not the only person seeking sanctuary around the country. And she is not the first person that the Biden administration has given a stay to. Now, as you said, this isn't the end. She still needs to go through the system to decide whether she actually meets the criteria to seek asylum. She fled Honduras saying that she had a former boyfriend who was violent and would kill her, and that she did not want to return fearing for her life. Her parents live in Utah, and so that's where she's going to stay now while her case continues to go through the courts.
Her attorney at the same time says that Congress needs to act. You know, he's advocating for immigration reform, for a pathway to citizenship, not just for her, but for the many people, the millions of people who are here and who don't have the, you know, the legal status that would allow them to stay, you know, with all of the with everything that that entails. I guess I don't know where to go with this. ICE has yet to remove, as I understand, Matt, some of its fines. There have been changes in the fact that they have been lowered. The Reverend Tom Goldsmith at the First Unitarian Church has an opinion piece in the New York Times about this, where he talks about the fines that were levied against Chavez and others who were in sanctuary that, as you said, were as high as $500,000, $500,000. If I'm not mistaken, her fine is currently at $60,000, and the Unitarian Church and other churches around the country that were those sanctuary churches are suing ICE and the Department of Homeland Security. And I guess we just wait to see what happens with those cases in terms of the, you know, the financial burden that she's stuck with.
Right. And I think that, you know, we've seen this for years and years now. The United States' immigration policy is a mess, and Republicans and Democrats would tell you the same thing. What they haven't figured out is how they want to change it in a way that they can get enough votes to pass it through Congress. This has been something that George W. Bush said he was going to solve. It was something that President Barack Obama tried to get a bill through. It obviously got cracked down during Trump. And Joe Biden has offered a bill, but it is not anywhere near the top of the priority list in Congress at this time. So the changes in the immigration system might be more small, as you said. It might actually happen through the courts at this time.
This might be a moment to bring in editorial page editor George Pyle, and just on the whole story, George, we've got someone who sought sanctuary and didn't set foot outside of the church for 3 years for fear of ICE, of Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials coming and taking her and her family, or conceivably just her, away. And then at the same time, you know, volunteers at the church were there around the clock, you know, keeping an eye out to make certain that that didn't happen, that they didn't enter the church, because, as Matt said, it wasn't, it's not a law. It's just sort of an informal deference to houses of worship. But yeah, 3 years inside of the confines of a church and then, you know, being allowed to go free. George, what are your thoughts?
Well, first, elections have consequences. She wouldn't, if Donald Trump had been reelected, she and her family would still be hiding in that church. I think it speaks very poorly of the United States that we can't resolve this, that it swings back and forth depending on who's in the White House, whether our administration of immigration laws and asylum laws are based on some tincture of compassion at all, or whether they're based on basically xenophobia and hatred. And clearly under the Trump administration, our immigration policy was based on hatred. I mean, that's all they had. They had nothing else, just fear of the other. Under this new administration, some policies are changing. There's the Biden administration is still not settled on exactly what it's going to do with asylum seekers, how many asylum seekers it's going to allow. There's some groups in Utah who are organized to help asylum seekers and refugees, and they've been asking the Biden administration to get off the dime and move ahead in the way it said it would, to be more welcoming of asylum seekers, refugees, and take advantage of the many volunteers here in Utah and around the country who are willing to sponsor refugees, find them places to live, find them jobs, keep them moving forward in a legal way, in a way that doesn't make them wards of the state, and to do what America has been doing for 400 years, which is to take in people who don't have anywhere else to go.
George Pyle is an opinion columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. And actually, that I'm going to remind listeners that you can join this conversation by tweeting to us. Our handle is at KCPW, or you can call 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. And this brings us, Matt Canham, to a story that also has to do with policy relating to immigrants. But as George is pointing out, in this instance, it has to do with refugees. And what a refugee is has a very specific definition under international law. Right. And it's people who are, you know, displaced by conflict, who basically can't go home because of war. And so refugee resettlement is something that happens under international law around the world. It plummeted during the Trump administration, despite, you know, those obligations that the country has under those laws. Maybe you can set this up for us. What happened to America's refugee resettlement program during the Trump years, Matt?
Sure. Well, first off, I'll say during the Obama years, it went up year after year. And when Donald Trump won, one of the first things he did is he put a travel restriction on seven nations. It went through the courts in the campaign. He said he wanted a Muslim ban. It did include a few countries that were not predominantly Muslim, but the majority of them were. He also, as any president has the power to do, can set the number of refugees that this country is allowed to accept. And he continued to ratchet that down. At the end of the Obama administration, he signaled that he wanted to have more than 100,000 refugees allowed into our country. Last year, Donald Trump said he would cap it at 15,000. Only 11,000 actually made it. So in Utah, which is one of the most welcoming states for refugees, we went from 1,200 refugees resettled into our communities in 2016 to 238 last year. And it is far less so far this year.
And that's where that's the basis for a story that you wrote this week, which is that, Joe Biden, President Biden, campaigned on sort of undoing that Trump policy on restarting our refugee acceptance program and significantly increasing the numbers of refugees that we were going to accept. But Utah refugee organizations who you spoke to are, you know, they're dismayed because that has not happened yet. Right.
Right. And this is an interesting thing, and it shows how our government works in some ways. Joe Biden campaigned on this, saying that he was going to restore the refugee program, saying he was going to get rid of the Muslim ban. When he was elected, and when he first came into office, he signed, he got rid of the travel ban on those countries. And then he promised to sign a declaration that would increase the number of refugees allowed in our country from 15,000 to 62,500 for this fiscal year, which runs until the end of September. And then for next year, he wanted to jump it all the way up to 125,000, more than even President Obama ever agreed to. What happened is nothing. The president never signed the document. So as of today, we're still living under the rules that were in existence during the Trump administration. And what made this even more problematic is people within the State Department that run the refugee program listened to what Joe Biden said as a candidate, listened to what he said in the first days of his administration, and started to act. They started to ramp up. They got flights scheduled for refugees that have been waiting for years and years in refugee camps or in other countries. But when President Biden never signed the document, they had to cancel those flights. They had to, in some cases, they just canceled the refugee case for these families altogether, making them go back to go through future bureaucratic hurdles if they are ever going to get here at all. And so these refugee resettlement programs in Utah, that's the International Rescue Committee and the Catholic Community Services of Utah, they also were ramping up. They also were talking to people that said, your loved one's going to be able to get here finally. And then they had to call and say, I'm sorry, the president didn't act and we had to cancel their flight. And we don't know what's happening now.
Hmm. And so it's sort of an expectation that whatever Biden did, meaning if he was going to change policy that he would have done it sooner in his tenure. And what is it that he has to do? He has to, I mean, for this to you know, start again or to become welcoming of refugees who are, again, fleeing places like Syria or places where conflict has prevented them from returning home or has displaced them. Which is almost a euphemism for, you know, the trials and travails of war. But what does he have to do for that to start up again?
He has to sign a sheet of paper. That's it. And it's really, you know, talking to the refugee resettlement people and talking to actual refugees who have made it to Utah, it's a very opaque system. They'll have an interview scheduled, a background interview, and then it'll just be canceled and it won't be rescheduled for years. Cases are constantly delayed and it's never really clear why. And this from the Biden administration is also opaque. The press secretary says this is a high priority for the president and he is going to sign it, but there is no indication of exactly why this is taking so long. There is no reason other than probably politics. Aidan Bitar with Catholic Community Services of Utah, he believes the influx of migrants at the southern border is creating political pressure and that Joe Biden doesn't want to sign this increase in the refugee numbers because of a political crisis that, as you pointed out, migrants coming across the border, even someone in the situation like Vicky Chavez, who is seeking asylum, are different than refugees. But that, and for many people, the two are conflated. And he thinks that's why the president hasn't acted.
And just, Matt, Utah, the state of Utah has a pretty strong history with these organizations that do resettlement. In some instances, I mean, we're a state that resettles quite a few more refugees than other states do. Is that correct?
It is. Per capita, we do quite well here. It's a very welcoming state. One of the changes that Donald Trump put into place was that governors could decide to participate or not participate. And there were a number of Republican governors that said, we don't want any refugees. And former Utah Governor Gary Herbert sent a letter to the president saying, we want even more. Utah's government is very involved in this and helping to create a refugee center that provides additional resources and job training. Our current governor, Spencer Cox, is continuing the same sort of support that came from the Herbert administration. So Utah as a government is all in when it comes to the refugee program. We have two strong resettlement groups. Most of these refugees are resettled in Salt Lake County, though there's also a program starting in Ogden. There are apartments ready to go. There are volunteers ready to go. When the president signs those documents, those refugees will start returning to our community.
Though you point out that in 2019, a third of the nation's resettlement agencies either closed for good or suspended their programs. This is as a result of the drop in refugees that that the Trump administration put into place. George Pyle, editorial page editor, Matt Canham's reporting on this is about the fact that just one signature and we could restart accepting refugees. I don't know. Do you want to weigh in on the delay in that happening? And yeah, what do you see in this?
Well, it's too bad that Biden hasn't followed through on this promise yet. As Matt said, people had heard what he said and expected him to do what he said he would do. Plans were laid, tickets were bought, families were notified, paperwork was filled out. But until this one last bit falls into place, all that is for naught. As Matt said, I would imagine it has to do with the what's going on the southern border and the right wing media circus where they're trying to make that 10 times worse than it really is.
George, you're breaking up a little bit.
And becomes radioactive. Okay, yeah, and the whole thing becomes politically radioactive, and I would think that I don't know how it could become more of a hot button issue than it already is, and so I would think it would make sense for the president to go ahead and keep his promise.
Matt Canham, I guess you have no idea when that, you know, promise might be kept. I think that inevitably there are people who hear this who you know, who are less welcoming of people from anywhere else right. in the world, and think of it as a good thing that that the United States isn't resettling people fleeing war. But, you know, don't we have some legal obligations to do so? You know, whatever the numbers are, we have some obligation to do that.
There's obligations, but there's also just it's a part of what we've done in this country for quite a long time. It's part of our fabric of who we are as we welcome people from around the world. And there has been some negative interactions that Utah's refugee resettlement programs and Utah's refugees have experienced from people who don't want them here. But the majority of them feel incredibly welcomed, and they're still optimistic. You know, they really had a rough go under the Trump administration. And so even with Biden's delay here, they're trying to stay upbeat because they see a better day for the refugee program coming soon.
Okay. Matt Canham is senior federal government reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. And Matt, we need to head to our first break in the show, but thank you for your reporting on this. And I will direct listeners to check out the article in the Salt Lake Tribune at sltrib.com. You are listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. When we come back, we'll turn to a new homelessness czar for the state of Utah. We'll be right back.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is supported in part by our members and Apogee Instruments, a Cache Valley company, building precision sensors that support global research in sustainable food production, renewable energy, and climate change. Support also comes from Palmer Home Furnishings, offering a variety of sofa love sets, dining room, and bedroom furniture. Located at 1670 South Highway 165 in Providence. Information at palmerhomefurnishings.com.
Hi, it's Francis Lamb. This week, we learn why it should be our duty to eat more sea urchins. And really, it's a job you're going to want to do. We learn about a wild technique for homemade falafel, and internet superstar Allison Roman gets us going on ways to really make breakfast the most important meal of the day. That's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
Tune in Sunday at noon here on UPR.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Matt Canham and Taylor Stevens, and editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. It's our live Friday morning Utah News Review, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. And Taylor Stevens, let's turn now to homeless services in the state of Utah. There's a sort of new model coming online for the state's system, and it includes a statewide homelessness coordinator, which I've been referring to on the show as a homelessness czar. That position has now been filled. Governor Cox has appointed someone to that role. Who has been appointed to that role?
Yeah, so he announced earlier this week that former Senate President Wayne Niederhauser will be filling that role. And Niederhauser is an accountant, a real estate broker, and a member of the Pioneer Park Coalition, which is a community group that works to address some of the issues around homelessness in the Rio Grande area.
Okay, so as a member of that board, maybe some interaction with the topic of homelessness, but I guess why Wayne Niederhauser? He's a former Senate president. He's a well-known politician, but other than that Pioneer Park Coalition connection, may not necessarily be known for his work on homelessness. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the other familiarity he has with homelessness is that he was serving in legislative leadership during Operation Rio Grande, but not a lot of on-the-ground work with people experiencing homelessness. And that's something that he acknowledges is a blind spot and that he says he's going to be working to counter by listening to service providers and some of the unsheltered folks. But what he says will be his strength is that he knows how to navigate policy and that he has strong leadership skills. And also some of the folks that I've spoken with about his appointment believe he has the political capital that is necessary to really make some progress on a very complicated issue like homelessness.
How are homeless services providers in Utah responding to this appointment of Wayne Niederhauser as the new? This is also, we should say, a part of a new strategy, a new model. There's a new office, some new money, I believe, as well. Can you describe the new model and then also, I guess, wrap into that how homeless services providers are responding to the announcement?
Yeah, so these are, as you mentioned, some big changes coming to the way that the state thinks about homelessness and manages homelessness sort of from a governance perspective. So the old system has been described as very confusing and complex and inefficient. The governor a few years ago called it a ship with 12 steering wheels. And there were some challenges that were identified with the way that they were managing homelessness, namely that there were too many people involved and that it was difficult to really know where the buck stopped and who was ultimately responsible for addressing homelessness in the state. So these changes came as a result of some legislation that passed through at this year's session that basically just seeks to reorganize, restructure, and the position of state homeless services coordinator, which is a full-time position, someone dedicated, 40 hours plus a week to addressing homelessness, also is going to be housed in this new Office of Homeless Services. And so they're really just trying to streamline these processes so that you know where the accountability is and the transparency is. So that's sort of where this change comes from. As far as how the service providers are responding to this change, I definitely say there are some concerns. People, I think, would have liked to see someone with more on the ground knowledge of how to serve unsheltered people, what the best practices are. And Niederhauser, as I said, acknowledges he's got a lot of work to do on that front. However, there are some groups that are really lauding his appointment, which was made by the governor. The governor in his appointment notes Niederhauser's sort of leadership skills, as I mentioned, and the Pioneer Park Coalition, of which he's a member, also says they think that he's the right person at the right time to fill this seat, that he has solved complex issues and proven himself to be able to solve complex issues through his time in the legislature. And it will just be really interesting to see what Niederhauser ends up prioritizing in this position. I sort of was asking him what we can expect from him, and it sounds like his first priority is to really get in there and talk to folks, get a better understanding of the situation on the ground. But he has indicated that housing is a big piece of it, mental health treatment, and he also indicated that he sees law enforcement as a part of the equation as well.
Can you put this into context for us, Taylor? I mean, like, how significant of an issue is homelessness today in our communities? I know that you went to the dismantling of a homeless camp, and we can get to that that occurred this week in Salt Lake City. But do we have a sense of numbers of how many people are experiencing homelessness in our communities?
So anecdotally, we're hearing that there are more people experiencing homelessness on the streets and in the shelter system today than there were a year ago. And I say anecdotally because it's really hard to track. And the state does an annual census, point in time count is what they call it, of people experiencing homelessness. And we don't have those numbers back yet. So we're not able to say yet to what degree there are more people experiencing homelessness or to what degree this has just become a more visible challenge. One thing that we wrote about earlier this year with the library closed, that many more people experiencing homelessness have been spending time outside during the day. That's just become a more visible problem for some reasons as well. But also what we're hearing from service providers is that there are more people who are seeking services. So we should know the scope of that in a few months when we get some of the numbers back. Okay. Right now, it's just hard to say the degree to which that is happening.
Well, you saw some of the challenges of this issue firsthand on Wednesday when here in Salt Lake City, a big homeless encampment was cleared by county and city officials with the assistance of Salt Lake City Police. officers as well. Where was this happening? And explain, I guess, why it was happening.
Yeah, so this happened in Salt Lake City's Fleet Block area. Some people might be familiar with the colorful portraits of people who've been killed by police. This has kind of become a community gathering area over the last year or so. And these cleanups happen with a lot of regularity. The health department conducts them. They say that they're necessary to address environmental and health concerns at encampments and just concerns that come as a result of people living outside, whether that's needles or bio waste, garbage that can be a problem. And so they do these with regularity, but this is a particularly large camp and also one that has just gotten a lot of attention because of the activist community that sort of helps out in this area. And also happened sort of on a bad day for, you know, kind of making everyone pack up their things. It was very rainy. The winds were, you know, we all in northern Utah sort of experienced those wind gusts earlier this week. And so, you know, this was just an attempt to kind of clear folks out. And there had been some complaints from residents and business owners in the area, but also there are some neighbors who are opposed to these kind of abatements and say that they don't actually address homelessness, that they just re-traumatize folks.
Camp abatements, meaning the saying, I mean, well, it's the packing up of camps or the dismantling of these camps. And as you said, residents and business owners in the area were not happy about the camp in their neighborhood. The sort of obvious question here, and actually I've got a clip of this one, of this cleanup. I was at the cleanup myself, and Dale Keller, who is bureau manager of the environmental health division at the Salt Lake County Health Department, what I'm trying to hint at here is that there's his job is a bit repetitive, meaning that they do these cleanups and then they have to do them again. Let's just listen to that clip really quickly, and then I'll come back to you, Taylor.
Do you expect to have to do this again sometime soon?
Unfortunately, right now, success in many ways is moving from a fatigued area, what this clearly has, from businesses and neighbors really, really frustrated about the garbage, the trash, the feces, the needles, those type of things. And so, yeah, you're right. The vast majority of these folks are not going to avail themselves to the resources that are available to them. And so, unfortunately, we probably will be doing this with the same individuals down the road. The city will do the best they can, though, to maintain the integrity of this location and keeping it clean.
And Taylor Stevens, is that the case? I mean, the same people keep getting moved from place to place. And so, you know, these abatements are going to have to keep happening. In fact, I think there's a movement afoot to see them increased. Is that correct?
Yeah. And, you know, like Dale mentioned, this isn't a permanent solution. This is a Band-Aid that, you know, we'll see happen again and again, sometimes with some of the same individuals. But yeah, as you mentioned, the Salt Lake City Council is currently weighing whether to pass a budget amendment that would provide an additional $650,000 for voluntary police overtime shifts. So to be clear, the Salt Lake County Health Department is the one that conducts these camp abatements, but the city assists by providing security. And that's both for any folks who may be distressed by the cleanup, as well as for some of the activist population that has started showing up at these cleanups to sometimes, you know, yell at police and yell at the folks, and those can become sort of tense situations. But the council has yet to vote on that. But part of the reason why they are considering this is because the police have attended a lot more of these health department abatements over the last year. They attended 640 in 2019 and 1,071 in 2020. And they anticipate that there will be at least 500 more of these camp abatements over the remainder of the fiscal year. And so they're trying to decide whether they want to you know, allow more police to attend those. And a lot of neighbors came out at that council meeting last week when they were discussing this. Some are in favor of, you know, these abatements and say that they're a necessary way to address the impacts that an encampment can have on a community. And others, again, like I mentioned, they say that this is ineffective, that it doesn't address the root causes of homelessness. And where could the city put $650,000 that might actually help people move off the streets rather than just sort of pushing them from place to place? And I just wanted to add one other thing. You know, Dale Keller mentioned that many people have been offered services ahead of the encampment cleanup. And we are seeing that there's a little bit more room available in the shelters, but, you know, there is a gap in the number of shelter beds that we have now compared to within the old road home system. And so that is one reason why people don't seek shelter beds, is because there are no shelter beds available. And we're seeing now that the overflow spaces are closing this week. And so that could put more pressure on the street camping population. Salt Lake City did opt to keep their overflow shelter going for another 2 months. So that will help. But, you know, part of it is the services aren't there. And then there's also been fear from some people experiencing homelessness about COVID within the shelters, which we haven't seen has been quite as big of an issue. But, you know, it's really complex issue, homelessness, and it's never as easy as saying that people just are refusing services. There's a lot of complexity that goes into that.
At this camp dismantling, I talked also to Lex Scott, founder of Black Lives Matter Utah. She was there protesting this action, protesting health workers taking away people's belongings. She also said that she thinks the solution, I asked her a question directly, you know, what, how do you solve this? And for her, she said more shelter space. Dale Keller, for his part from the health department, said that the, you know, that the abatement he does is about when it gets to a kind of tipping point, in terms of it becoming a public health issue. And yeah, I guess maybe we can move. Actually, let's bring George Pyle in on this. George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist, before we move to some of the housing part of this story. But George, abatements, you know, happen from time to time, and actually are happening more and more because of the congregations of people who set up camp on the streets, and then you know, neighborhood residents and business owners saying, "We don't want this here." I don't know. It's a really, as Taylor pointed out, it's a very complicated situation, and I don't know what to ask you other than to say, is it wrong? Is it right to try and clean these up? The thing that I think a lot of activists are concerned about is the taking away of people's personal property, forcing people to move from place to place.
Yeah, it's an awful thing to have to have to do, and I accept the health department's judgment that these encampments become health hazards, and that's what the health department does, is clean up health hazards. The Mayor Mendenhall, Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall, says we need another shelter. The shelters we have.
George, we're losing you. I'm sorry. George is bringing up the point that there's a need for more shelter space, and that's something that Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall brought up in a conversation with the Salt Lake Tribune editorial board. And we might be able to get you back in a second, George, but I'm going to bring Taylor Stevens back in on the conversation. And Taylor, just on what the mayor has said, one thing she's advocating for is more, you know, shelter space, meaning overflow or resource centers, something along those lines. You have also been talking to her about tiny homes. The idea of a tiny home community is something that the mayor is committed to. Can you talk about that in the context of shelters?
Yeah, well, the mayor, as you mentioned, is really behind this idea of creating a tiny home village or community to help people experiencing homelessness get off the streets. That's one major challenge that the service providers are seeing right now, is that there's just such low vacancy rates, and landlords really have their pick of, you know, people that they want to allow in. Some people won't take a housing voucher, or are less willing to, you know, house someone who's had an eviction eviction in their past. So there are all kinds of complexities in getting housing in the market that we have right now, which we know is just a red hot market. So the mayor sees this tiny home village as a way to sort of improve the affordable housing stock in the city and help people, you know, get into a space that is more, you know, that they're more supported, that they have access to more resources than they would in an encampment. But one thing that she mentions, and, you know, we've seen this over the last few years, is that there are many people who feel a sense of community in encampments, and that when they get into an apartment, they feel like they may struggle to adapt, or, you know, may have lost that sense of community. So she says that that's a benefit of having a tiny home community where people have, you know, others they're surrounded by who have come from similar places in life and can sort of relate in that community atmosphere. And she says that she is working toward a pilot project on the tiny home as soon as this November. And so we could see this become a reality. We haven't really heard, you know, there's a lot of questions that remain on where will this go? How big will it be? Who will run it? You know, there are a lot of questions that remain, but it sounds like there is the political will and political capital to get this done. And interestingly, a lot of folks from very different perspectives on homelessness all seem to agree that this is a good idea. So there are activists who feel this is a good idea. Government leaders, the Pioneer Park Coalition expressed some interest in a tiny home village in a recent newsletter they sent out. So this does seem to have broad-based community support, and we could see something coming on it pretty soon.
I wonder what will happen when a location is announced. There's, you know, as we saw with homeless resource centers, there was reticence by some communities to accept a shelter in their neighborhood. Do you know what site selection might look like? Is it too early to say?
Yeah, it sounds like the city is eyeing a couple of locations. And, you know, one of the challenges is finding a place that's big enough, because you need to have a significant amount of acreage to really make this work. So it sounds like they are looking at some of the property that they own, maybe some other government owned property. But I asked them that question, you know, are you anticipating that a not in my backyard mentality could derail this kind of effort? And, you know, a lot of folks recognize that that's a potential challenge, is, you know, convincing a community that would be close to this that it's a good idea, or that it should go there. We're not quite there yet, but I know that city leaders are thinking about that and trying to figure out how to make their case to whichever nearby community this comes to. So that's something that we will definitely be watching out for.
Okay. Taylor, thank you for your reporting on this. We do have to head to another break in the show. I'll let people know that over at KCPW's homepage, you can find my conversation with Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall. We didn't touch so much on tiny homes, but we did talk about shelter space. And then also the show features some audio from the dismantling of the Fleet Block homeless encampment. That's in KCPW's In the Hive over at kcpw.org. Find Taylor's reporting and all of the reporting we've been discussing over at sltrib.com. We're going to take a quick break and back with some more news from... well, from Utah in this past week. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll take a quick break and be back in a minute.
Support for Utah Public Radio programming comes from our members and S.E. Needham Jewelers, importing hand-selected diamonds from Antwerp, Belgium, offering trained diamond gemologists and GIA-graded diamonds. 141 North Main Street in Logan. Information at seneedham.com.
I'm Jay Ellison, producer of the Moth Radio Hour, and I hope you'll join us for our show here on Utah Public Radio, with true personal stories told live without notes to standing room crowds around the world. Moth shows are renowned for the range of human experience they reveal. That's the Moth Radio Hour, Saturday evening at 6, right here on Utah Public Radio.
Also heard Friday mornings at 11 here on UPR. That's coming up today.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Taylor Stevens, and George Pyle. This is our Friday morning local news roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255, or tweeting to @KCPW, though we are actually kind of low on time in the show here. And so we are going to turn to some headlines that members of our federal delegation have been grabbing. Actually, we'll probably stick with just one story. Matt Canham, this is your beat. Senator Mike Lee is unhappy with Major League Baseball. Tell us why he is unhappy with them. And Matt, I think we have you muted. I'm sorry about that. Are you there?
My apologies.
You're fine.
In Georgia, the legislature and the governor approved a law that changed a lot of the voting requirements. And that for, you know, liberals, but also certain business leaders, they thought would restrict voting. And it's been a very contentious issue. Major League Baseball was going to have its All-Star game outside of Atlanta. And the commissioner decided to send a message. He was going to move the All-Star game and the draft. And now the All-Star game is going to happen in Denver. And when that happened, conservatives, including Senator Mike Lee, were furious that there would be an outside influence on the law. And he almost immediately tweeted that he wanted to pull Major League Baseball's antitrust exemption.
And what does that exemption do? And did he tweet this as, I mean, is it just tit for tat retaliation?
And yes, definitely. I mean, that is what it is. You know, it's an interesting thing. An antitrust exemption is, you know, in our system, we want to have competition, and we believe that competition will lead to lower prices and better quality services. And when you have an antitrust exemption, it means that the government says you can be a monopoly. You can stop competitors from getting into your business. Major League Baseball, because of a Supreme Court ruling in 1922, has an antitrust exemption. None of the other major sports leagues do, which is why at times you've seen, you know, startup football leagues. You can't do that in baseball. Wow. So it would be very hard. Because of this antitrust exemption. And so Mike Lee, in retaliation, wants to strip that. You know, you can argue that there is a legit reason to strip that antitrust exemption. Lots of people criticize that Supreme Court ruling. But the only reason he's bringing it up at this time is because of that Georgia voting law.
Right. I guess I don't know if Major League Baseball responds to the calls for the stripping of that antitrust exemption. Are they responding to, you know, a move to punish them for moving their game, the All-Star game, out of Georgia? Are they?
There's been little response from Major League Baseball so far, but there have been other attempts over the years to get rid of the antitrust exemption, and they fight it vigorously. So I assume they'll do that as well here, though the likelihood of this bill from Senator Lee moving forward is very small in a Democratic-controlled Congress.
Okay. Matt Canham is with the Tribune, a senior federal government reporter with the Tribune. We're running out of time, and so we're going to have to turn to our underplayed stories of the week. George Pyle, I'm going to try and bring you in on this once more. Any comments on Mike Lee and trying to punish baseball?
Well, it's just ridiculous what he's trying to do. I mean, most of the time when big business wants to do anything, Republicans are all there for them, saying, you know, corporations are people, my friend. But then when a corporation wants to do something they don't like, then all of a sudden they're abusing their power. There's a two full page ad in the New York Times and the Washington Post earlier this week from 100 corporations and business leaders saying that they thought that any kind of voter suppression legislation in any state was bad and they were against it. They're making these business decisions.
Hey, George, can I ask just quickly, and you'll have to do this in a very short period of time. You know, the argument that is made on the other side is that actually this isn't about voter suppression. It's about ensuring the safety of the vote.
Well, the only reason anybody's talking about ensuring the safety of the boat is because of the bald-faced lies that were spread by Donald Trump and others calling into question the safety of the vote. There was nothing wrong with our last election. It worked as it was designed to work. It worked under extraordinary circumstances with the COVID pandemic and other things. It worked very well, but the Republicans didn't like the way it came out, so they're spreading lies about that there was something wrong with it that needs to be fixed. And the Georgia law as it came out wasn't quite as bad as earlier drafts, wasn't quite as bad maybe as some people are making it, but the fact that it exists at all is only in response to Donald Trump's lies.
George, we're going to stick with you for a pick for Underplayed Story of the Week, our final segment. George Pyle is opinion columnist and editorial page editor with the Tribune. Have you got a pick for a story that we may have missed?
Well, I mean, this is one of those things that may be underplayed just because it's become so normal. This morning, we have a mass shooting at a FedEx facility in Indiana. Yeah. And yesterday, we had the revelation that Chicago police had shot dead a 13-year-old boy, lied to the court saying that boy was armed when he was not. And these are the things that, you know, they're almost underplayed because they're just so normal.
Hmm. This is America. Matt Canham, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
Sandy is going to have a new mayor, and there are seven candidates have lined up so far. The city council there is considering changing to ranked choice voting as an experiment this year. This is something we've seen in a few other cities, and Salt Lake City is considering it as well. And for voters, that would mean instead of voting for one person, you would rank all of the candidates in order that you like them, and then they'll be sorted out as they count the ballots.
A weighted voting system as an experiment in Sandy, and we'll see how it goes and whether any other jurisdictions pick it up. Thanks, Matt, for that pick. Taylor Stevens, your pick for Underplayed Story.
Yeah, I want to highlight a story from my colleague Bethany Rogers. She reported that shootings of Utah livestock, including cows and horses, have really skyrocketed during the pandemic, and it's not clear why, but she does some work to try and come to a few answers, and just a really interesting read.
It is an interesting read. You can check that out at sltrib.com. Thank you, Taylor. For my part, I'm going to do a story about KCPW, which is the host of our Sunday night jazz music program. Steve Williams is leaving town. He's moving to Chicago, and so we will we'll miss him, and travel well, Steve Williams. We'll be running reruns for a little bit of his show for a while. He'll be curating those. Anyway, you can find out more information about that at kcpw.org and all of the reporting that you've been hearing about at sltrib.com. Taylor Stevens, Matt Canham, and George Pyle, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you so much, and happy 150th anniversary for your newspaper.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you for noticing.
That does it for Behind the Headlines here on KCPW, a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. You can join us live every Friday morning and find podcasts at kcpw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. Join us again next week.
What is climate change? How is it affecting our lives? And what can we do about it? We'll connect the dots, from energy to extreme weather, public health, the economy, agriculture, and more. Catch Climate Connections weekday mornings at 5:49 and 8:49 on Morning Edition, and afternoons at 3:48 during All Things Considered, here on Utah Public Radio.
Listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, and also heard at upr.org.